Next item, next and final item, the North Atlantic right whales. Combination of the Science Center, Gafo, and Mr. Alexander.
Hi, this is Colleen Coogan, the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Team Coordinator for the Greater Atlantic Regional Office. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yep.
Great. And introducing here also Dr. Sean Hayes, a Protected Species Branch Chief at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. We're going to give you a quick update. Hopefully this won't take too long. And I'll take the next slide. So Sean Hayes will be giving you a quick update on the preliminary 2019 right whale population estimate that was released with the last month's North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium meeting. Unfortunately, I can only give you a very quick update on the status of the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan modifications. It's not as available as we hoped it would be, so that won't take very long. And that will include a quick update on the DEIS, the proposed rule, and the batch biological opinion. And then primarily Sean will give a quick update as well on the ropeless fishing technology work that's been done over the past year. So with that, I'll let Sean take over on the next slide.
Thanks, Colleen. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. This slide is a trajectory of the population broken down by the total population as well as adult males and females within the population, since we have that resolution. We assess the population using a mark and recapture model that takes advantage of the unique callosity patterns on each animal that each animal has on their heads, and then Northeast Fisheries Science Center and many partners conduct photo ID surveys, both vessel-based and aerial, and all contribute these data to a photo database managed by the New England Aquarium. This model allows us to provide annual population estimates with very high precision, particularly for the older population estimates, as more rig site data in future years works to help resolve prior model runs, evaluating whether individuals were still present or are gone from the population. Next slide, please. The model allows us to also measure basically the interannual survival rates within the population by sex and age class. From the period of, and what you can see here in this graph is from the period of 1990 to 2010, survival was fairly high, allowing a positive population growth, and was also very stable with, for in the blue lines are the male survival rates and the red lines are the female survival rates. The summary statistics here are that in a given year from 1990 to 2010, survival was typically about 97% for females to survive each year. But that changed significantly around 2011, and survival decreased and both became more variable, but with an average survival rate between 2011 and 2018 of 94%. Next slide. The population grew slowly from the 1990s through 2010. From about 270 whales initially in 1990 to an estimate of 481 in 2010. A paper published by scientists at the center in 2017 demonstrated the population decline began after 2010, as illustrated in this and previous slides. That period was marked by an ecosystem shift in the Gulf of Maine and Greater Northwest Atlantic that changed the distribution of right whales to areas without regulatory protections in place, as well as reduce the apparent fitness of the right whales in that they seem to be struggling to find food resources. In particular, it also reduced, this contributed to a reduced number of calves being produced each year. And throughout this period, there is evidence of persistent serious injuries and mortalities caused by both vessel strikes and entanglements in fishing gear. The population decline was particularly accelerated in 2017 when there were 17 right whale deaths documented in the Canadian and U.S. waters. As detailed on this slide, since 2017, there have been 32 documented right whale deaths and 14 additional serious injuries. These are injuries that we classify as most likely to result in death. But this is just a fraction of the mortality that is happening out there. Since 2017, the population has actually declined by roughly 60 animals, or 15% of the entire population, and from its peak in 2011, it's declined by 115 animals. And note, that is a population decline that also includes 100 calves being born during that same time period. So we're talking about roughly 200 plus right whale mortalities from a population that had less than 500 animals at its peak in the last 8 years. The details of what we've seen are presented in terms of visually observed, in terms of source of mortality, are presented on the slide. However, these detections are both anecdotal and highly biased to areas where intense survey efforts are done for population assessment purposes. It does not mean that those areas are where all the mortality happens. The relative impacts of the two sources of mortality are uncertain, beyond that they are both significant to the population. In recent years, there's been slightly more confirmed deaths of vessel strikes than entanglement, but there are major differences in the detectability of these two sources of mortality. Speaking bluntly, a fat whale basically floats when it's struck by a ship, but a skinny whale that's been swimming around entangled in rope for many months to years typically just disappears and sinks without a carcass that's ever recovered. Most of our serious injuries are actually entanglements, and those animals are rarely seen again. And we know that 85% of the population has been entangled at least once. And I'll transition to Colleen here and let you go to the next slide.
So some of this is familiar to you from past presentations that we've done. As a result of the 2017 paper and the large mortality event, we reconvened the take reduction team to reconsider measures in the plan and see if more measures needed to be implemented. And that resulted in a near consensus bunch of recommendations in April 2019, primarily geared at reducing the number of vertical lines in the Northeast lobster and Jonah crab fisheries and reducing the strength of those lines. We spent the following summer and fall, as did the states, doing a lot of scoping with stakeholders. And in December of 2019 and in early 2020, received proposals from the New England states that were aligned to some extent, though not exactly the same as the recommendations coming from the TRT meeting. So this spring, we developed alternatives, analyzed those, drafted an environmental impact statement and a proposed rule, and put them through DOC and NOAA clearance. And as of the first week in July 2020, those have been in review in OMB. We were hoping that they would now be published for our comments and we could get start getting our comments now, but those have not yet been released. We're prepared to turn them around quickly once they are released, and then we'll file the proposed rule and the notice of availability of DEIS in the Federal Register for a 45-day public comment period. Right after that, we will be holding informational public meetings really geared at orienting people on the documents to help them review them quickly and get back to us with public comments. And in addition to being able to submit public comments in writing, we'll hold three or four meetings designed to take public comments. We hope to, you know, accelerate our turnaround of the final documents so that the rule and the FEIS are available by May 31st, 2021. This comment period is shorter than what we would have liked, but we think it's needed to get the rule turned around by that time. That May 30, 2021 deadline is the one established by the court in the Center for Biological Diversity et al. Litigation. And if the consultation isn't completed by that date, the 2014 opinion on the lobster fishery would be vacated, and there wouldn't be ESA Section 7 coverage for continued operation of those fisheries. In order for that opinion to consider the impacts of our rulemaking on the fisheries, we need to have some, you know, reasonably foreseeable indication that the rule will be in place. So that is the current schedule still, and we hope to have a draft biological opinion available for discussion with you in the January 2021 council meeting. In addition to work on these rulemaking packages, NIFS has made significant progress working with fishermen to facilitate the development and testing of new tools to reduce entanglement risk for future consideration in lieu of closures. such as ropeless fishing technologies. Sean Hayes is going to be up again to give us an update on that collaborative effort.
All right. Thank you. With an increased use of Canadian waters by populations of right whales, this species is now between the U.S. and Canadian waters, exposed to several million vertical lines as they migrate through their annual habitat transitions in both nations. In an effort to find a once and for all coexistence solution to ensure the economic security of these important fisheries while ensuring the survival of this and several other species that are experiencing entanglement risk, the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, in partnership with other NOAA offices along the East Coast, proposed developing a ropeless fishing technology program late in 2017, and it really got its first start in 2018 with some internal funding. This was followed up by some funding from the NOAA Species in the Spotlight program in 2018, and then in 2019, we were provided $1 million to accelerate this program's development with a mandate by Congress to do so. And so I'm providing you an update on where we've come in those past 3 years, particularly in this past year since the funding has increased significantly. I'll start with what is the definition of ropeless. Ropeless is really a semantic that pertains to essentially removing the buoy and the vertical line that connects the traps from the bottom to the surface, and then providing alternative mechanisms of recovering the gear. This is not meant to imply that there's a cessation of using ground lines to connect traps in trawls. That's a question we often get asked. What has emerged in the last few years is sort of three different styles of retrieval systems for recovering the buoy or the gear from the bottom of the ocean. The first, all of which typically rely on an acoustic communication system between the vessel and the fishing gear on the bottom when using an active retrieval mechanism. These include a pop-up buoy that's essentially, you have rope stowed on the bottom, that is a lot, and basically you send a signal down and the ropes, the most popular configuration is rope stored inside of a trap of some sort, and then a release device is signal ascent, and the buoy is basically allowed to float up to the surface from the buoy or from the trap on the bottom and unspooling rope as it goes. A similar mechanism is buoyant spools, where the rope is on the bottom but coiled tightly on a spool, and then the spool itself just starts to self unwind. And then the third mechanism involves no rope on the trap at all, but other than the connecting ground lines, but rather an inflatable lift bag releases pressurized gas into the bag at the bottom after receiving a signal, and then this floats to the surface. This is beginning a lot of interest, obviously, in recent years as an alternative to closures closures to fishing activities as North Atlantic right whale entanglements have increased, as particularly as measured by scarring. And we've already mentioned the significant population impacts that have occurred in the last couple of years. Next slide. Our current status for a ropeless testing program is that the testing program, we have been working with 10 different companies, including three styles of ropeless systems as previously designed. So there's at least 10 companies that are producing ropeless technology. Three are already commercially viable, and one of them estimates they could produce, with a significant order, could produce 100,000 units within 2 years and 1 million units within 6 years, to get a sense of what the sort of production capacity might be for this technology. We've also been experimenting with, particularly for shallow, more coastal areas where there's less risk of entanglement, but high densities of gear, the idea of, rather than having an on-call system for the purposes of reducing costs, having either a galvanic release or a timer release system, where essentially if a fisherman is going to be setting gear and they know they'll be back in 4 days, they can put a timer system on the buoy that allows it to sort of pop up to the surface sometime before they're going to be back, say 3 days. For custom ropeless systems being designed specifically, right now we've been having testing in different depths of water. And so we've, based on feedbacks from trials with fishermen, we've been taking their consideration and implementing design changes so that to adapt the different types of available ropeless technologies that seem to work better in shallow versus freshwater systems and making significant modifications to ensure those challenges. We have been had a lot of successful testing in shallow waters in the Massachusetts area, and COVID prevented us from doing as much testing as we had hoped in the offshore waters during 2020. That being said, significant testing has still actually happened thanks to the dedicated efforts of several partner fishermen. The logistics and physics of working in the deep water have proven more challenging, but not impossible than we've had. Some boats have been highly successful in their testing, and other boats have had more challenges in getting the gear successfully deployed and recovered. And we hope to advance that significantly in 2021. We've also expanded the capacity of our social science branch to conduct basically the economic analysis of what are the impacts of a ropeless fishing transition going to be to a fishery, and what are the ways to mitigate that, and are considering several scenarios with that, including, you know, the idea of vertical line reductions through other methods besides just ropeless fishing. Next slide. Our current challenges and ongoing developments, and I want to just catch up on my notes here, is the physics of getting the gear to and from the surface of the ocean is really just a physics problem, and we've been working on that for several years now, and that's been our main focus. We've long recognized that the major challenge is actually going to be the gear conflict issue, particularly between mobile fishers and fixed gear fishers in this environment, and we've been working on ramping up the effort to sort of resolve that problem, not sort of, but to how will that problem be resolved in a future where ropeless fishing would be more viable. The other concern that we've been looking at is enforcement issues, and obviously a lot of enforcement is based on enforcement vessels being able to sort of go out and either pull or recover traps and evaluate, you know, trap tags, et cetera. One of the things that has always been a problem with or without ropeless fishing is enforcement in the offshore water. Our enforcement vessels just have lacked the capacity to pull the large heavy duty traps. And as a result, they are adapting to a technology of they're exploring now using ROVs so that whether there's a rope to the bottom surface or not, they can send ROVs back down to basically evaluate the trap without having to actually evaluate the entire trawl without having to pull it, so it can be left in place. So this would be an enforcement solution regardless of ropeless fishing or whether there's ropeless fishing or fixed gear fishing. The technology we think is going to be the solution for gear conflict and ropeless fishing is essentially expanded acoustic communication. And this is not unlike the mechanism that by which we think of our Google Maps on all of us having GPS track cell phones in our pockets now, and those data are all mined to provide, you know, real-time traffic updates on Google Maps or whatever other sort of navigation software you might use. We just, rather than those data being tracked by light waves and radio waves, so they would then be tracked by monitored by acoustic waves. And we envision that there would have to be a future where essentially the transponder and echo sounder technology that already exist on most of the vessels would be upgraded such that it could both detect and transmit a signal from a ropeless, a fishing trawl that had ropeless fishing technology on it, so that it would basically receive a signal that ropeless fishing gear was in the surface, and a map would basically be available that would appear on any given fisherman's trap plotter or trawl, plotting device, so that as they're moving through an area, they would receive near real-time updates of what gear is where on the bottom. Obviously, this has concerns to the, particularly to most of the fishery about having to adapt to a new technology. On the other hand, there are benefits of being able to see gear when you might not otherwise be able to see it in low light conditions or in rough weather. It would always be there. We're also getting early reports that the rookless fishing gear tends to move less because there isn't the drag on the vertical line or surface buoy that often pulls it around in storm events. So there is some increased success in gear potential and gear recovery for that as well. We are sort of beginning the process of exploring this in other fixed gear fisheries, including the gillnet fisheries. We're also understand that we have to work through if all of these data are going to be tracked, there needs to be a recognition of privacy individuals. We envision a scenario where essentially as fishermen moving into an area would be able to see gear on the bottom, but they wouldn't necessarily know where gear, whose gear is whose. It would just be that there are objects on the bottom, much in the way that they could see buoys on the surface, but wouldn't know exactly what buoy belonged to who. That being said, if gear is moved in some way, either because it's accidentally, hooked by a storm, either a trawling vessel or another vessel, by storm, the situation would occur where basically the next time a vessel moved within or transited by that gear within range of the acoustic signal, which is already potentially a couple kilometers, that boat would receive an encrypted message saying, here's my location, and that boat would be able to essentially update the private database, and a fisherman would essentially get a private email saying, your gear has now been found at this new location, you can go recover it here. Another part of this, we're in early days of doing all of this testing, so one of the things has been to authorize ropeless fishing in the short term is through the electronic or EFP requirements, and I'll transition to Colleen here with the next slide about how that is going to be handled moving forward.
Well, right, the need for exempted fishing permits right now, exemptions or authorizations, it's required because they need to do any ropeless fishing right now, they need to be exempted from the current buoy marking the bottom gear requirement. And that's extra work for fishermen. We do have, I think, 4 exempted fishing permits out now for people who are actively using ropeless fishing and experimenting with it. We have another one we anticipate getting in the near future. And shout out to Henry Milliken at the center and Eric Mattson for helping fishermen develop their requests for their exemptions. But that is extra labor. And if and when surface marking has been replaced by another ability to see the gear on the bottom, we would want to phase out that surface marking requirement so that an exemption wouldn't be required anymore if there were going to be areas with broad ropeless use. An additional management update is we did publish an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in 2018. We do have existing seasonal restricted areas that are closed to fixed gear fishing. And we are going to be modifying those, or we hope to modify those to allow ropeless fishing. So it would be closed to buoy lines. We did get comments back on that 2018 advance notice of proposed rulemaking, and we are continuing to consider putting that in place as a separate rule or incorporating that option into our larger TRT, take reduction plan modification rule. And again, if we come out with new closed areas or new restricted areas under the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan, we probably would make those closures to buoy lines rather than closures to actual fishing. And I believe that is the end of our presentation today, except for taking questions.
Thank you very much for the presentation. We're going to open it up to questions. Start with the council members first. Ms. Ware.
Thank you, and good morning, Colleen and Sean. A couple of questions for you guys, if that's okay. My first question, Colleen, is about the public comment meetings. I think you said there would be three or four. Are those going to be organized in any way, like by region or LCMA, or is it a come one, come all?
So I also neglected to say they will be posted on our website as well as in the documents when they're available. But we, you know, they are public meetings, so we can't restrict who shows up at them. Our plan is to target them regionally. So we'll have three or four on the front end that are, you know, presenting, orienting people on the documents, and three and four on the back end to take public comments. And we will target them regionally, but anybody, of course, could attend.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm just trying to plan out things on our end a little bit. My next question, I think, is more appropriate for Sean. And I would agree that this is in regards to ROPLESS, kind of the challenges with enforcement of ROPLESS and how we overcome that. I know that ASMSC, maybe a year or two ago, engaged their law enforcement committee to provide some initial comments on ROPLESS. And I guess I'm just wondering what, if any, ongoing conversations there have been with either OLE or the state Marine Patrol offices as the ROPLESS testing is going on.
Sorry, I had hit mute and was getting back to it. Those conversations have been continuing internally with our federal enforcement. That issue and challenge is really kind of the next phase of our development. The first couple of years were just focused on, is it even feasible to get this gear to and from the bottom of the ocean? And particularly we had very limited funds during 2018 and 2019 for testing that. So before we sort of went on developing whole enforcement plans and gear conflict solutions, we wanted to see whether it was even possible to get the gear to and from the bottom of the ocean. Since then, the congressional funding that we basically received and became active in the middle, available for us to start spending in the middle of 2020, and right in the middle of COVID, we've begun entering into those considerations and much more aggressively. And one of the things we did with the initial resources was we partnered with National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and made a donation to them. And they recently just made a significant award to Massachusetts DMF to run a scoping session on all of this that would include conversations with enforcement, mobile gear fisheries, fixed gear fisheries, and other stakeholders that would be involved in this issue to essentially conduct an assessment and feasibility of all of that. So we recognize the strong need to have that issue resolved, and that is very much next up on the problem solving effort.
Okay, thank you. I was not aware of the Mass DMF meeting that will be coming up. So if there's more information on that, that would be great to know. And I'll just emphasize kind of the importance of reaching out to those state Marine Patrol agencies, since they're the ones that primarily haul the gear and do the enforcement through the JEA agreements. Mr. Chair, if I can have one more question.
Sure.
Thank you. My last question is, I think also for Sean, I guess I'm just trying to understand what NOAA sees as a timeline moving forward to deploy ROPLESS. Do you guys have a timeline you're trying to work towards, or projections of where you think this will go into place?
The timeline to moving forward is both a technological challenge and a policy challenge. In my personal experience, technology advances faster than policy. Our TRT meeting was coming up on a year and a half ago, and we're just sort of getting out the rulemaking for that. So I think that the ROPLESS fishing, we're looking at potentially having ROPLESS fishing being available to closed areas once they're in place in low density areas within within 5 years for sure, potentially sooner, potentially significantly sooner, depending on the cost of the gear and the density that's in a closed area. It really comes into, we want the ropeless fishing to be trialed first in areas with minimal gear conflict, because that's the harder part of the solution that needs to be worked out. And we envision having sort of a small group of fishermen with the resources, probably through government supplementation, to be able to get into those areas initially, and to use ropeless fishing, and then having it get the sort of use of it become, as people get more comfortable with the technology and the word, and the sort of the evaluation of the feasibility of the technology increases, and hopefully it becomes truly more feasible, that we see it sort of spreading into more complex scenarios of both working in harder more difficult habitats, as well as in more complex situations in terms of gear conflict, where there's sort of more resource users in the same region. And that's when the acoustic marking technology will come online. There are already some prototype systems in simple apps where, you can essentially just sort of mark a site on a map on your cell phone with some of the company's apps, and any fisherman who has that same app can go to the area and use that now. We envision something more sophisticated, being technologically feasible in 5 years, and then, between technological and sort of market availability and policy issues, available probably in 10 years at a widespread level. Those are speculative numbers, but I don't see them as being impossible timelines.
Thank you. Ms. Griffin.
I may, Dr. Chair, a few questions regarding the development of the take reduction measures and the pending buy-up for the agency, perhaps for the RA as well.
Sure.
Much of this is really seeking clarification given the number of moving parts involved here on right whales. And so the first one, regarding the batched buy-up, we've all been pretty focused on lobster gear, of course, but could you just clarify for me which fisheries, and perhaps more precisely which permit holders, will be discussed in the forthcoming buy-up on right whales?
I don't have the list with me. I understand there are 10 fisheries being considered. I can get that for you.
That would be great. Thank you. And then my second question regarding the take reduction measures and the TRT plan, that's been, as you showed us, it's been under review since the summer. And I'm curious if the delay in getting that out is more in an administrative holdup, or if there's something more substantive. If it's the latter, I'd be curious what you can share, if there are any new or modified management measures being discussed that have not yet been presented to the TRT. And I guess another way of asking that is, does the TRT plan for states remain in play, or should the states expect to develop more conservative measures than they've already committed to?
So as is usually the case with take reduction team measures, the measures we propose are not necessarily exactly what the team recommended or what the proposals have provided. That only gets a part of your question. I think Mike is taking the rest of that question.
With your permission, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Mr. Pentney.
Yeah, so thanks for your question. We can't say what changes or if any may come out. We've submitted the rule as we drafted it, and we're working through the comments that we receive on that. Once we get clearance to publish the proposed rule, we'll be able to share what's in it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it on my end.
Okay.
I do have a list of the FMPs that are being considered in the batch biological opinion, if you're still interested in that.
I am. Thank you.
Okay. So it's the American lobster FMP, Atlantic bluefish, Atlantic deep sea red crab, Jonah crab, monkfish, Northeast multi-species, Northeast skate complex, spiny dogfish, summer flounder, scup, black sea bass, fisheries, and I believe that's all of them. Oh, squid mackerel butterfish as well.
If you wouldn't mind, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe you could email that to the executive director or the staff, and they can distribute that to the council members. That'd be great.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Chair. I couldn't type fast enough.
All right. Next up, Dan Salerno, then Balzano, then Tracy. And just one quick announcement. I've got to step away to something. So Mr. Reed is going to take over as chair. So Mr. Salerno.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you both for that. That was a very informative presentation. I do have one comment and a question. This is probably more related to directed at Dr. Hazer. My comment is under the ropeless technology, you outlined some of your challenges that you see moving forward. And I would encourage you to probably think about mobile gear as well, particularly in this region where most of the fisheries, besides the lobster fishery, are conducted with mobile gear and mobile interaction with something that they don't know is there. It could be a very big problem for both sides of the fishery. My question, and please want everyone to understand, I'm not trying to minimize the concerns over the anthropogenic causes of mortality of the right whale population. But my question is, are there any proposed or current investigations into changes in the natural mortality of this population? You know, I'm thinking anything along the biological and environmental effects that are causing, that are adding to the decrease in the population of the right whales. Thank you.
Yep. Okay, so just addressing the first part, we know that the one of the largest roadblocks to the feasibility of ropeless fishing is working out an economically viable solution to the gear conflict issues of mobile and trap gear fishing, and that's a large part of why we worked with NIFWIF and to develop a funding mechanism for that. And there's a feasibility study that has been funded to MassDMF. In part, we thought that was one of the wonderful partner to have on that because of the amount of mobile fishing that happens in the Massachusetts region in particular. The issue of speaking of the issue of other sources of mortality with North Atlantic right whales is a excellent question. It's sort of the population goes up or down because of two reasons. It's deaths and births. So speaking on the death side of it first, there's been in almost all of the cases of mortalities that we've been able to recover a necropsy of right whale and figure out what was the cause of mortality. For adult right whales, we have not observed a natural cause of death in this population. And we put probably 2 to 3, if not 10 times the amount of resources into recovering North Atlantic right whales that are found dead and floating to ensure that we can understand what that cause of death is compared to other species of large whales like minke whales and humpback whales, where there are current ongoing unusual mortality events with those species as well. And we have regular documentations of natural mortality in those species. So it's not to say that natural mortality isn't happening in North Atlantic right whales, but the reality is the mortality of the anthropogenic causes for the adults in the population is happening so much faster that we rarely see a natural mortality of a mature animal in this species, particularly in compared to other species we are also monitoring in the greater Western Atlantic. Now, the other side of that question is the ecosystem shift. These animals are migrating further. There are changes in Callinoid copepod densities in the Gulf of Maine that sort of have resulted in their change in distributions and limited probably their access to food resources. Those are their primary food resource. And these animals do seem to be skinnier in general. And there's also some pending data, preliminary data suggesting that overall animals are maturing at shorter lengths in the last decade or so as well. So it does suggest that there's a food resource limitation in the population that is part of what is contributing to we have a decrease in the calving rate in the population. So while animals may not necessarily be dying from natural causes, we suspect that there is a component that natural causes are contributing to the limit reduction in the number of animals being born, which also limits the population's recovery rate.
Okay, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. That kind of goes along with what I've been reading and hearing.
Mr. Balzano?
Thank you, Mr. Executive Director. Thank you for the presentation. This issue has been touched upon, and probably my question has been answered, but I think it's important to ask it again. And this is a gear conflict nightmare as far as I can see it. And what have you done to date in your studies, and what do you plan to do in the future in your studies to avoid user conflict and gear conflicts?
In the short term, we've worked with a small number of fishermen in very specific areas to mostly test the feasibility of just getting the gear to and from the bottom of the ocean. And in those situations, they've been working typically with at least one buoy still on the trawl, so that for other fishers in the area, we've been minimizing the gear conflict in that way. So they're testing, you know, the recovery of the gear with ropeless, but because there are, you know, it's not common knowledge that there are ropeless fishing tests happening in specific regions, where we're still using buoys on the surface. The technology, there's two paths to this. One, there's sort of the social awareness of the solution, and then there's the technological component to the solution. And we're working on the social awareness solution through funding things like our NIFWIF grant to MassDMF, which is going to do a feasibility study and engage work, have a series of workshops that are supposed to reach out to all of the concerned stakeholders, including council members and industry reps, to get their input on what their concerns are and work through all of that. In addition, we're also developing the technology so that there is a tool so that rather than necessarily seeing a buoy on horizon, you can see a buoy on your chart plotter. Just as easily and potentially with more precision than you do see the buoy on the horizon, and farther out than you might have seen a buoy on the horizon, recognizing it, you're also seeing a lot of the gear with radar reflector technology as well. So we envision there being, we know that there are gear conflict challenges that need to be resolved. We also see some gear conflict solutions as a function of going to ropeless gear. Like we basically, if all the gear is acoustically tagged, we see a great reduction in the amount of ghost gear that's out there when gear gets moved and dropped somewhere else and no one knows where it is, because it's very likely that the gear won't actually be lost. As soon as the vessel passes within a few kilometers of it, it'll update the database on its new position. So those are technological solutions that we see being long-term benefits to this challenge. In terms of, there's a timeline to all of this too. We suspect that in the short term, the social agreements that exist between the mobile and fixed gear fisheries are going to continue to be a necessary part of the process, and that ropeless will start in areas where those social agreements are already fairly well established and be prioritized in those areas to take advantage of that, so that they're not trying to trawl in areas where there's a lot of fixed gear during a particular time and season. And also to just sort of strategically have ropeless fishing start up in areas where gear conflict is already minimal. And then as we get more comfortable, the entire community, fishers, agencies, enforcement, get more comfortable and greater understanding of the technology and the challenges, we plan to increase the complexity of that if it's needed for management purposes over time.
Thank you. So I'd say it's fair to say that there's a lot of work to be done.
Absolutely. This is not coming tomorrow.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Balzano. Mr. Vice Chair, I have Mr. Tracy next, followed by Mr. Alexander.
Mr. Tracy.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just a quick following up on Mr. Salerno's question, and I apologize if I missed it, but what would be the normal mortality rate for this population of whales within a given period of time? And again, I apologize if I missed that. But again, if not for any accidents, gear conflict, or entanglements, et cetera.
So prior to 2010, the mortality rate was about 3% per year for the adults, or that 97%. So 3 in 100 whales would die per year. And part of that, most of that was anthropogenic causes, and we were over what's called PBR. The best sort of comparison is that the South Atlantic right whale populations, or the Southern right whale, not Atlantic, there's several populations of right whales in the Southern Hemisphere where there's far less fishing pressure. Basically, since the end of commercial whaling in the Southern Hemisphere, that population has been growing at almost exponential rates. Those animals are living to 70 years or more. And so since the end of commercial whaling in the Southern Hemisphere, those animals haven't lived long enough to actually start dying of natural causes. So there's been almost no observed mortality in the Southern Hemisphere, period. Whereas in contrast, the North Atlantic right whale populations are lucky if they make it to age 35. So I don't know if I gave you the... So essentially, the mortality could be effectively zero without anthropogenic causes for the next several decades, other than neonates. There's always sort of mortality, you know, with neonates and juveniles and the offspring from, they're more susceptible to more natural causes.
Okay, well, I appreciate that answer. I think there's a lot to core into on that, but that wasn't the question I had teed up. It was just a follow-up. And Mr. Vice Chair, if you don't mind, I hopefully can ask another question, and it has to do with economic feasibility, which you've addressed with the gear conflict issue, and certainly it sounds like there's a lot to be done on that front, understandably. I'm also interested on individual economic feasibility with fishermen and what kind of work's been done in profiling as individuals move to this new method of fishing with the ropeless, whatever the technology is done. Has there been any, and I understand it's conceptual and there's a lot of development that remains to be done, but has there been any conceptual kind of profiling of what an individual fisherman fishing so many traps based on what they're currently losing per year of converting to this new system? Has any of that been done?
Yes, there aren't results from it. The work is the analysis is happening of it. Partly there's the uncertainty. You see a lot of quotations in the paper why ropeless can't work, because it's quoting the price of prototype system costs. You know, so these systems costs in their prototype versions are, you know, thousands, if not $10,000 for a unit, right? And we know that is just not feasible. There's an engineering sort of rule of thumb that, you know, that for every order of magnitude that production goes up, the cost goes down in production. And you have to sort of think about what we're talking about here is what an iPhone can do today compared to what the cost of a similar computing power cost 5 to 10 years ago is what we're sort of expecting with ropeless fishing. It may not, you know, that's just almost pure technology, where this is sort of physics, hardware, stuff that has to work in marine environment over and over and over again and be really rugged. So it's going to be more complex than that. But we do expect the technology to come down so that the cost per unit does get substantially cheaper in the next few years for fishers. We expect that it's not going to necessarily also be a one-to-one just replacement of everywhere there was a vertical line, there's now going to be a ropeless fishing gadget attached to the end of a trawl. We suspect that there are going to be additional management considerations of either just, you know, no buoys and only a ropeless fishing unit on one end of the trawl, and in many areas if that unit doesn't work, grappling is a pretty feasible solution to get it back up to the surface as your backup, as opposed to having the second buoy. There's also, you know, the constant evaluation of whether or not there's too many lines out of there, and we just need to consider line reductions and trap caps and as part of the package, so that, you know, the fishery may be, you know, through policy processes may be incentivized to evolve to fishing with fewer traps, so that you don't need to buy, you know, 50 ropeless units, you only need to buy 25. There's also the economics being considered of the lobster fishery has gone from sort of a green, socially, conservationally good catch to, because of the entanglement with whales, it's been slipping down into the amber and red zones of some of the fish watch lists. And we see a potential for an emerging market of a sort of a whale safe lobster or other or crab product that has a higher price point that incentivizes ropeless fishing too. So we know that it's an expensive transition, and we see challenges, but we also see opportunities, and we don't have solid dollar looking for that feedback to make sure that we consider as many economic consequences as possible. The other thing I forgot to mention is, as part of our working with fishermen, we are putting scientists on the boat with the fishermen to evaluate the sort of the timing cost to recover. Does it take them more time in their day to recover a trawl that has a ropeless system on it versus a traditional buoy? And the guys that are doing it are already moving very quickly and having positive success. And it's one of the misnomers was, you have to sort of drive up and hit the button and then wait for your thing to unspool to the surface. And now some of the technologies are such that when you're en route to your next trawl to pick up, you can hit that signal, send that signal, a couple kilometers out from your unit so that it's already at the surface by the time you arrive. So things like, the time cost to using this equipment is also being considered in our economic calculations.
All set, Mr. Tracy?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's important work, but thank you very much for the explanation.
Okay, great. Before I go to Mr. Alexander, I'm going to take my turn. So, and I appreciate the presentation, but your characterization of social relationships, as far as I can see, the relationship between fixed gear and mobile gear is reasonably antisocial already. And I just hope you're aware of that. You're going to have to analyze the economics of adapting the mobile gear fleet, the mobile gear operators who number in the hundreds, if not more, because they're going to need sensors to see multiple signals and multiple frequencies, and that cost is going to be substantial to them. So I hope you consider that. It sounds like you will. With that, Mr. Alexander, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So this kind of led into the conversation I was going to have when I reported out to you guys. So I think I'll, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Vice Chair, I'll give my report, and it doesn't answer any of these questions, but it brings up some more questions for the rest of the council to ponder, I guess. Is that all right with you?
I'm very social today. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. So the day before the last council meeting in October, the special one that we had, I attended the Ropeless Consortium, which I've attended all of them since they started up in 2018, I believe it was. So I've done three of those here so far for the council. And the technology seems to be evolving, but it isn't evolving enough to reduce the cost of, every time I ask about cost of these things, they always go, oh my God, it's a prototype, don't worry about it, and as a business owner, I do worry about cost. If we push this on the people that we regulate to be one of the first people out of the box, it's going to cost them a ton of money, because that prototype isn't going to be built, isn't going to be mass produced at that point. So the initial people are going to pay the price for this. And they always talk about all this foundation funding and all that stuff for it, but nobody seems to be stepping forward with that. But my takeaway from that Ropeless Consortium is that they are going to be pursuing regulatory changes to allow ropeless fishing up and down the coast. And I don't know what that venue is that they'll pursue that in. I'm assuming it's through ASMFC, and probably each council, because we're the ones that regulate the people that do that. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Mitch has a different idea of that, but I was starting to think where they would go. They talked about recovery rates for these buoys. The recovery rate is 95%. That they tout at all these meetings. I go and talk to different fishing organizations, lobstermen who are actually fishing these things. They say, now they're telling me that 90-95% if you set it out in Cape Cod Bay. If you're setting it on Eastern Georgia's where the tide's running, they're looking at 60-65% failure rates. So, I mean, there's a huge difference between up in the bay fishing and offshore fishing with these things and the way the tide's running and all that stuff. So, you know, there are a lot of flaws with this technology. You know, somebody like me who fishes offshore, you know, they're focusing their work on people who are close to shore who can download where Eric Reed's gear is before he leaves the dock, and be able to see real time on the bottom where everybody's gear is. You know, just keep updating all day long. Well, somebody like me who fishes offshore, we don't have that luxury. We can't download updated information every day. So we need real time information. So that means hauling all these mobile gear boats out and hauling them on the railway somewhere and putting a transducer on them. And, you know, a bigger boat, you're talking $20,000-$25,000 just to get the damn thing out on the railway and put a transducer on it. That doesn't include the cost of the transducer. And how many transducers do we need is another question, because all these things work on a different frequency. So there should be a uniform frequency that we're trying to transmit to. So since that came up, since the ropeless thing, John Papalotto and I was on a webinar with gear marking webinar with Woods Hole, the Woods Hole Institute, to talk about gear marking. First week in November, a Friday morning in November, and you know, they've been concentrating so much on ropeless technology for making these buoys go off and people being able to retrieve their gear. They left out a big portion of the fishery, which is the mobile gear fleet, who are going to be severely impacted by this, because we need to be able to see ahead of us, you know, if there's lobster gear or gillnet gear up ahead of us, because we don't want to get that gear. All that does is screw up our tow, screws up that guy's gear, and nobody's making money at that point. You know, we want, that's why we have high flies and stuff, so we can see them a ways away, so we can plan our tow around mobile fishing fixed gear. Sorry, but I mean, if you're towing down an edge and the gear is on your port side and the wind and the tide are coming out of the start off your starboard side, I mean, trying to turn up against that wind and tide sometimes is a Herculean task that we can't get away from that gear over on the port side. So the further away we can see this gear, the better for us. Let's see, what else did I have? Anyway, and everybody else has the same questions I had. Since that day, Mark Baumgartner, I think his name is, at HUI, asked me to look for people to test this in a place where they actually have a mobile fleet. And so I reached out to Libby Etri and to Eric Reed, because that's the only place where we have a day fleet left where they could actually that work around the lobster fleet a lot. So I don't know where that conversation will go, but we are looking to make it an actual on the water experience for people to see what can happen. Now, that Mark asked me to do that, and I haven't heard from him since, so I reached out to those guys, and I don't know where we are with that at this point. So that's all I got, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Alexander. Mr. Neese, I'm going to have to raise feature over to you. There's nobody else on the council. I think Mr. Donovan is first in line for the public.
Yes, sir. It'll take me a minute to find him again. He's unmuted. Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there was a question earlier about enforcement, so I just wanted to let folks know that we continue to stay engaged in this technology, both at the federal level as well as with our state partners at the JEA level. So as it gets closer, obviously our engagement will increase. That includes the general counsel when it comes to the requirements of the technology and evidence collection and everything else that we do when there ever is a new technology. So just to let folks know that enforcement is completely engaged in the program. Thank you, sir.
We have no other hands raised at present, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay. I'll go back to the council. Anybody else want to talk at the council? Denise?
We have no hands raised. I don't know if the regional administrator wanted to make any brief comments about the petition for emergency rulemaking that I think was released yesterday.
Mr. Penley?
Thanks, Mr. Vice Chair. So yes, the agency received a petition for rulemaking yesterday submitted by the Center for Biological Diversity, Conservation Law Foundation, Defenders of Wildlife, and the Humane Society of the United States. I saw it yesterday afternoon with the council meeting, have not had a chance to read it yet. We have a process that we follow for the review and handling of petitions for rulemaking. That process is what we will use and is just getting started as we have staff available to take to read through the proposal, the petition, and understand what actually is being asked. And that's all I have.
Okay, Mr. Penny, thank you. Unless somebody from the council has a burning question they want to ask on this, it's a little premature to have a robust discussion on it, but anybody on the council want to have a shot at this? Tom?
There are no hands raised, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. With that, thank you, Ms. Coogan. Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you. So
thank you.